You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Kedarcher Kent. The number of homicides in Milwaukee dropped about 15% this year compared to last year. Still, about 120 people died a violent death, mostly from gunfire. Milwaukee police say they hope they found a way to keep down the number of murders. But as Chuck Kornbach reports, there's caution in the community because a lot of things can affect the homicide total.
Looking at who was killed in Milwaukee this year, young African-American men continued by far to be the majority of victims. The Milwaukee Police Department says 80% of the dead were black males and 70% were between the ages of 10 and 40. One of the youngest victims was 16-year-old Imani Robinson, who was caught in a crossfire outside a grocery store. At a neighborhood vigil in July, Robinson's mother, Latasha Davis, spoke about her son.
He was funny. He had a big heart. He helped everybody. His smile was contagious. He loved to dance. And that's exactly what I'm going to miss about all of it.
In another high-profile killing, a City of Milwaukee housing inspector, Greg Ziskevich, was shot in March during an attempted carjacking. After three young men were charged with the shooting of the employee, nicknamed Ziggy, Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett called it a very difficult time.
This is still a personal nightmare for Ziggy's family. It's still a personal nightmare for the city family and for all people in this community who want this to be a better city.
There could have been far more homicides in Milwaukee. The police department says the number of non-fatal shootings in the city has gone up about 2% this year to about 560. But at a recent news conference, Police Chief Ed Flynn said the number of shootings and other violent crimes went down this fall in part of the city where officers conducted a traffic enforcement surge. Flynn says a similar effort will start next month.
We believe we can sustain this responsibly, and we're going to undertake to do that while we develop longer-term plans to make this a permanent part of our interventions.
Mayor Barrett says there are other initiatives coming by spring from a blueprint for peace developed by the city's Office of Violence Prevention. The mayor says one program will use so-called interrupters in troubled neighborhoods.
These are not police officers. These are people who are trying to make sure that we are dealing with problems that they find out about before it reaches the point of violence, so to stop it before it escalates.
Barrett says he also worries about other factors that may be linked to homicides, like the availability of guns and the opiate and heroin crisis. Milwaukee Common Council member Terry Witkowski is vice chair of the Public Safety Committee. He also points to drug crime.
This does need to be addressed. It's not only law enforcement, but it has to be the community, it has to be treatment, and it has to involve people's support system, their family.
This year's Milwaukee homicide victims will be remembered tomorrow afternoon at an annual event called Milwaukee Lights a Candle for Change. It'll be held here at Our Savior's Lutheran Church.
Jesus, oh, what a wonderful time. I said Jesus.
Reverend Patrick Keene led the singing at a prayer service at the church on Wednesday, and he'll speak at tomorrow's event. He hopes violence can be reduced more by going beyond police, guns, and drugs and focusing on improving the quality of life.
We say that the biggest problem in Milwaukee is violent crime. And my response is that's a damned lie. It's the result of other problems. The number one problem is probably education and then employment and then housing and then transportation.
Keene urges governments to address those issues. But while waiting for what may take years, the pastor says he tries to reach individuals with a message of nonviolence.
That it's on us. If we want to see a difference, we can make the difference by being the difference.
Chuck Kornbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And we're experiencing some technical difficulties this morning. We're trying to get our next guest and working through some issues with our phone software here at Wisconsin Public Radio. We're going to turn our attention to a struggling New Hampshire town. It was home to the Groveton Paper Mill And people appreciated those jobs. 800 people worked for the paper mill in its heyday. Most of those jobs, they were paid union wages. The struggling New Hampshire town was home to the Groveton Paper Mill, and the town appreciated those jobs. And the employees who remember their time at the mill, they were generally found to be very supportive of the community. You're listening to The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. In 1992, Wausau Paper Mills Company bought the dying mill for the bargain price of $20 million, the Groveton Paper Mill. What came before and after in this mill's 116-year history amounts to a collective memory of sorts. There's a new book out. It's called A Job for Life, Story of a Company Town. Jamie Sion is a writer and an environmental activist. Since 2009, he's been working on this job. Jamie, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, we'll get to the specifics later in the interview, but Jamie, let's start by setting the scene for us. Tell us a little bit about the history of the town and paint a picture of what this paper mill meant to the town.
Well, the first chapter of the book is called The Mill Was the Life of the Town, and I think that really says it all. We are a very remote community. We're about an hour north of the White Mountains, Mount Washington and the other presidentials. We're quite close to the Canadian border. We're along the Connecticut River. And the mountains up above the White Mountains are in the 3,000-foot range rather than the 4,000 or 5,000-foot range of the presidentials. We're remote and very small communities. Groveton, in its heyday, had maybe 2,700 people living there, and yet the mill was supporting 800 or more jobs in that area. So really, it was the economic engine for almost all of the 20th century.
This mill dates back to the 1800s. It was in existence 116 years?
That's correct. It ground was broken in the spring of 1891, and by the winter of 1892, the mill was bankrupt and didn't make paper again for another 3 years until investors from Maine bought it and then pumped a lot of capital into it and revived it. And for the next 20 or 30 years, it was quite a thriving mill until the Depression.
What was the mill producing primarily? What type of paper?
Primarily, until after World War II, it produced fine papers of various sorts. A lot of school supplies, writing papers, mimeograph machine paper was a big deal in the later years. And then in 1948, they installed a tissue machine and began making toilet paper, napkins, facial tissues. And in 1950, they converted one of the fine paper machines, a machine called Number 3 paper machine that had been installed in 1907 and at the time was reputed to be the largest paper machine in the world. In 1950, they converted it to make corrugated medium, which is the squiggly paper that gives strength to cardboard boxes. And so the mill, unlike many paper mills that produced just one product, this mill produced a variety of products, which it was a good economic strategy for a small mill. If tissues weren't selling, fine papers and corrugated medium could pick up the slack.
Oh, it really diversified what it was producing in the mill, which helped it stay afloat?
Absolutely. As I say, when one product wasn't selling, you know, because paper is a highly cyclical industry, all their eggs weren't in one basket, and as a result, I don't think there were ever too many times when all three of their major product lines were really down. So something was keeping them afloat.
In late 2009, you started gathering stories from people who had ties to the mill as part of an oral history project. You eventually interviewed over 50 people. What made you want to collect these stories?
Well, originally I was taking an ethnography course, a graduate school course, and the term assignment was develop an oral history project. And A light bulb went off in my head. I have no idea why I thought of it, but I immediately thought, oh, the mill, which had shut down 2 years earlier, would make a great project. And I called a friend who had worked in the mill and said, I need names of people who can tell some interesting stories. He gave me several great leads. And after the first or second interview, I knew that I was onto something that was far more important and compelling than merely a graduate school project. And I would say within a few weeks, I knew I was going to be writing a book.
So what was your personal connection to the mill and to this town?
Well, I never set foot inside the mill when it was operating. And that's, of course, a disadvantage because I never had the privilege of seeing it working. But it, in a way, it was a kind of a helpful tool for me because I was so ignorant of how the machines worked and the entire process and culture that I had to ask very basic questions of the interviewees. And I think if I'd had a sophisticated knowledge of papermaking, I might have made some assumptions that my readership understood things that they didn't understand, but because I was starting at the same low level as I think the average reader might be starting at, I had to get clarity at a very basic level, and I think that helped me a lot.
Well, this town and a mill closure, it seems to echo across the entire country where we've seen car plants close, car manufacturing plants close, steel mills close, of course, paper mills, as we're talking about here. Do we too often miss out on the human element, the human stories, when a factory or a plant closes?
I think we do. And when we do focus on the human stories, it seems to be a fairly narrow range of, oh, these people are, you know, victimized by the latest clothing. There aren't any jobs, and that's about the extent of it. I think I was just really lucky to stumble into this wonderful story of a community that was, because we're isolated, it means that we developed, I think, our own quite distinctive culture. And the more I probed, the more interviews I did, the more people I met, the richer the story became. And I mean, some of the things I learned were just downright shocking. One of the early interviews, I learned that there was heavy drinking going on in the mill, and I thought, I wouldn't want to be drinking alcoholic beverages and trying to operate one of those scary paper machines, but this was common in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. There was also incredible stories of compassion and community spirit when a fellow worker suffered a family tragedy, a fire, a death in the family, a serious illness. There was always an envelope in the lab where they tested the quality of the paper, and anybody could stop by and slip a $5 or $10 bill in that envelope, and at the end of a week or two, the person who was going through a crisis would receive a very nice gift from his or her fellow workers.
For many years, the mill was operational. It was locally owned. How important was that to the mill's success, but also how important was it to the people who worked there?
I don't think that was really appreciated at the time, and I think it's profoundly important and appreciated now. At the time, the Weems family, W-E-M-Y-S-S, bought the mill in 1940, and old Jim was a real industrialist. He was one tough cookie, but he bought a rat-infested mill that was running two or three days a week, 2 years arrears in its property taxes during the Depression, and he revived that mill. Now, if you messed up, you heard from him, and it was not a pleasant experience. His son, Jim Jr., called by the town folks, young Jim, who's now 92 and living in Florida, came into the mill after World War II. He'd been seriously injured in World War II, and he was a 19-year-old kid who got shot up in the Battle of the Bulge, and he had been brought up with a silver spoon in his mouth, but here he was in this horrible war with all these kids from coal mines and steel towns and the like, and so even though he was from the upper crust, his life depended on these guys getting out alive with him. And I think that had a profound impact on how he related to the mill workers in later years. He was also a tyrant boss, but he cared deeply about these guys. He'd go fishing with them. He'd go carousing with them. Both father and son were deeply involved in every aspect of the mill. They went onto the floor, and when a paper machine was not making good paper, they would pitch in to pull the bad paper off the machine, get it out of the way, so that they could clean up the machine, get the machine running right and making paper and making money. These were not guys who, you know, walked through in a tuxedo once a year or so.
It is a 260-page oral history published by University Press of New Hampshire. It's a collective memory history, interviews with more than 50 people who remember a rural New Hampshire paper mill from its beginnings in 1891 to its abrupt closure in 2007. Author Jamie Sion's book is You Had a Job for Life. You can join in the conversation about a mill town and what it means when a town's lifeblood closes. 800-642-1234. Have you worked in a paper mill here in Wisconsin or elsewhere? What are your memories of the job and the people there? How did the closure of a paper mill affect your community? Join in at 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll be back with more of the conversation in just a moment. Stay with us. The book is a collection of more than 50 oral histories from a New Hampshire paper mill town. The Groveton Mill's closure a decade ago can be seen as a microcosm of what's happened around the country in recent decades, where the disappearance of manufacturing jobs in smaller towns and cities has had a dramatic impact on the heart and soul of communities. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The book is You Had a Job for Life, Story of a Company Town. Author Jamie Sion stays with us. You can be part of the conversation at 800-642-1234. Is there a Groveton-type story in your community? Do we too often miss out on the human stories when a plant closes? 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to Leah, who joins us from Milwaukee. Hi, Leah.
Hi there. Call in and share. I'm from northeastern Wisconsin. My mom worked at a paper mill up in Kaukauna, Wisconsin for about 45 years before she retired. The mill is still in operation, and I just wanted to share a little bit of the flip side of it. You know, I grew up in that community. Our river was dredged back in the 90s for PCBs. There was incredible environmental degradation throughout the community. My mom and some of her very, very close friends that she's still in touch with from the mill have cancer. She had duodenal cancer that she went through chemo for this past year, and a lot of it, I think, I have a hunch, has to do with some of the environmental degradation because of the mill. So there is a flip side. There's such community pride and such tight-knit communities in these mills, but I think there's also a darker side, and I think transitioning these communities to healthier, you know, healthier jobs and sources of community pride is also something to talk about. I'll take my response off the air. Thank you.
Yeah, Leah, thank you. Jamie, go ahead.
Well, Leah has spoken eloquently about the dark side of a paper mill in your community. In fact, one of the chapters in the middle of the book is called The Dark Side, and I talk about the drinking and earlier talk about the pollution, the smells, the health issues, the stress that swing shifts place on people, especially as they age. This was a fact of life that folks in Groveton lived with, and basically they accepted that this was the only really good-paying job they had, and so the cliche up here is the smell of the mill, the smell of money. One of the stories I was told, a newlywed would do her laundry, hang it out, and then the mill's boiler, which was running on coal in the early 50s, would belch out a plume of smoke, and it would turn her white laundry black, and she'd have to do it again. And she said, but it happened to all of us, we accepted it, and that was the way of life. I personally would have had a hard time accepting that, but I was profoundly moved by the kind of the stoicism of the folks who didn't have very many economic options, and this was by far the best economic opportunity they had. Some of the other hazards in the mill, up until probably the 60s or 70s, before OSHA, they would get trainloads of horrible chemicals, soda ash and chlorine and stuff like that, and often it wasn't packaged. They just shoveled it into a wheelbarrow and wheeled it to its destination. I mean, I can't even conceive of something like that today, but that was the fact of life, and it was a tragedy, but also it was the only game in town for them. One of the things that I hope can come out of the demise of the Groveton Mill and several other mills in northern Maine and also in Wisconsin, the mills that Wausau owned in Wisconsin closed down 5 or 6 years ago also. One of the things I hope we can do is celebrate the good of that culture, the paper industry culture, but also learn from the tragedies and the mistakes and not repeat them. And so I'm urging that instead of looking for another smokestack to come into town, that we try to invest in businesses and manufacturing that adds high value instead of commodity products and has a low carbon and low ecological and low environmental footprint, because we've learned the hard way what happens when you clear-cut your forest, when you pollute the air, when you dump dioxins and PCBs into the rivers. It's not nice.
Jamie, in 1992, the Wisconsin-based Wausau Paper Mills Company bought the Groveton Mill, ushering in a new era of ownership. How did that change things at the mill?
The mill was within a few weeks of shutting down. The previous owner, James River, had ceased to invest in the mill, and there is a simple equation. You invest in a mill, keep it modern, it remains competitive. You starve it of investment, and it quickly becomes obsolete in this competitive global environment. So by early 1992, the mill was more dead than alive, and Wausau had looked at buying it a year or two earlier when it was first put on the market and decided the asking price was too high. And when the mill looked like it was going to go down any day, Wausau took a second look, made a really rock-bottom offer. It was accepted.
$20 million it was?
$20 million. And to put that in context, Wausau's directors earlier that year had approved a $100 million investment to buy a new paper machine, and that would have also included, I think, some construction, you know, a building to house the machine. But they were willing to pay $100 million to expand their capacity because Wausau was a lean and mean company that was doing really well in the Midwest. And when Groveton came along, they got two fine paper machines and the mill for $20 million. That left a lot of money left over that they could invest in the mill. And in those first 4 or 5 years, starting on April 1st, 1993, when they officially took over the mill, they pumped a lot of money in. And some of the people I talked to said, we couldn't get a nickel to fix something that was, you know, not working when James River was running it. And suddenly, we couldn't spend money fast enough under Wausau. Now, the problem was that around 2000, the paper industry nationally went into a real serious slump. Wausau had expanded, I think, unwisely. In other words, faster and bigger than they should have, and their debt was pretty high. And when this slump hit, Wausau stopped investing in Groveton, and over the next 7 years or so, it was all cost-cutting. And that set the mill up to be vulnerable when the economic crisis came in 2007.
You really show how workers banded together during that slump, where they were cutting their hours uniformly so that they could shield themselves from layoffs. They were working extra hard in order to get the jobs done in the minimum amount of time to do it. So they were intentionally upping their productivity. Is that right?
That is right. And in fact, some of the stories almost defy belief. Let me put this in context. When the crisis began, Dave Atkinson, who was born in Groveton, his family had worked in the mill for generations. He was made vice president of Wausau and superintendent of the mill when he was in his mid-30s. And almost immediately, the troubles in the industry began. And Dave kept sending out messages to the employees. There are things that we cannot control. We can't control low commodity prices and high energy prices. But what we can control is our productivity. If we have a safer mill, a cleaner mill, we're going to lose less time to accidents. And so that means we'll be spending more time making paper. If we change paper runs faster, that, again, more time making paper and making money. If we make some engineering changes in how we use water, they ended up cutting the amount of water used to make a ton of paper from 20,000 gallons per ton down to 6,000 gallons per ton, which to me is mind-boggling. But they basically figured out which water they could reuse and which water they had to dump, and so they decreased the demand incredibly. And that had an incredible impact on their energy usage, because this was heated water, and by reusing already heated water, they only had to heat it up a little bit instead of a lot. So they used less energy to get the same heated water. And they did all kinds of things, increased the speed of the changes of one run to another. Their safety record was terrific. And in the end, it wasn't enough. They controlled the things over which they had control, but it was uncontrollable global forces that did them in.
You also point out that the company, Wausau Paper Mills Company, put a covenant on the mill after it closed, which forbade future owners from making paper there. I take it that wasn't well received by people in that New Hampshire town who had spent a lifetime working there.
Everybody was distraught when the mill closed, no question about it, and few people saw it coming. They knew there were troubles, but the mill had always been here, it always would be here, was the feeling. And I don't think anybody really understood the covenant at first, but a couple of the engineers decided to explore an employee buyout to keep the mill going somehow, and they wanted to approach Wausau and say, would you consider selling to us? And it was at that point they learned about the covenant. Now, the reason the covenant was attached to the deed, and it said, you can keep this building going, but you can never make paper in it again. The reason is that the paper industry is very cyclical. In good times, they invest a ton of money in expanding capacity. In bad times, the expanded capacity makes too much paper, prices crash. And this was a bad time, so they wanted to reduce capacity so that they weren't making so much paper and they could keep the price of paper up. Well, one way of doing that was shutting down mills. And so Wausau was afraid, I think, that if they sold the mill to somebody who wanted to continue making paper, capacity would remain high and prices depressed. And so by shutting the mill, they were making a small contribution to boosting prices. On the other hand, it was a devastating thing to have done to a community that had zero say in a life and death decision over it. So the people were upset that the mill was closing, upset that they had no say in it, but they felt betrayed by it was really just sort of the final slap in the face. You can't ever make paper here again.
The author is Jamie Sion. The book is You Had a Job for Life, Story of a Company Town. We're talking about a New Hampshire town and the Groveton Mill that produced paper there for 116 years. The book is an oral history collection of 50 interviews he did with people who had worked at the mill. You can join the conversation, 800-642-1234. Have you worked at a mill here in Wisconsin or elsewhere? What are your memories of the job and the people there? How did the closure of a paper mill affect your community? 800-642-1234. You can post as well on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jamie, what was life like in that town after the mill closed?
Well, obviously, severe depression. The earliest changes we notice probably are a few families start to move away, some of the younger mill workers with kids in school. So the school starts to lose or the enrollment starts to decline a little bit. The other immediately noticeable thing is that a major chunk of the town's property taxes came from the mill, and that just stops. Basically, nothing is happening. The storefronts are closing. The downtown is pretty much a ghost town. People who are in their 50s are lucky if they can get it. They've been making $20, $25 an hour at the mill. They're lucky if they can get a $6, $8 job at some of the places around the region. And often they had to drive 45 minutes even to earn that. So a really profound transformation.
The mill was ultimately demolished. What does the property look like today? What's going on there?
A small, I believe, furniture manufacturing operation that is headquartered over in St. Johnsbury, Vermont, about an hour from here, moved in the last year, and I believe they're employing about 35 to 50 people. So that's been the economic good news, but you have to remember that this past New Year's Eve, was the 10th anniversary of the closing of the mill, and really there's been no progress since then until this smaller outfit came in. Now, when the mill closed, it was employing about 300 people, and so it's nice to get 35 jobs or so, but there's still a long way to go to make up the gap.
That's a decade later, mind you.
That's 10 years later. I feel we've been in an economic depression for 10 years up here.
Author Jamie Sion started this book project in 2009 as part of a required oral history project for a graduate school class at Plymouth State University. Almost immediately, he realized that this would be an all-consuming project. The new book is You Had a Job for Life. It tells the story of the Groveton, New Hampshire paper mill and the people who worked there, who gave it their all to keep the mill going. Your thoughts on big industry in small towns. What happens when they leave, when the mill shuts down? 800-642-1234. We'll return in just a moment. Stay with us. As is the case in many small towns where a mill was closed down, storefronts remain empty, the workforce struggles to find living wage jobs, and the young people leave for bigger cities. We caught sight of these themes in the new book, You Had a Job for Life. Jamie Sion chronicles the story of a New Hampshire paper mill town through interviews with 55 people who were associated with the mill. That dated back to the 1800s. The mill was closed in 2007 by its owner, Wausau Paper Mills Company. And we're hearing about the tense relationship between corporate profits and keeping a local interest and local ownership. Your thoughts on this as well, 800-642-1234. Let's go to Greg in Niagara. Hi, Greg. Are you there, Greg?
Yeah, good morning.
Yeah, good morning.
Yeah, well, I lived up in Iron Mountain, Niagara, for like 28 years. I took a break, and I lived in the Fox Cities for a while. But during the time when I was living in the Fox Cities, Niagara paper mill was slowly closing down. And it affected probably about 200 jobs at the end there. Like, I said 200 families moved out, but probably 100 guys probably retired, you know. But the other 100 families, they had to move out. They had to find work.
So, Greg, what is the town like today?
Well, actually, Niagara's at, it changed to, like, say, I work in Marinette, so that's what I'm doing. I'm driving to Marinette for work right now. But actually, the air quality is better because you don't have the problems with the pollution coming off the plant. But it's going through a renaissance. You know, the city of Niagara is getting new streets, and they're no businesses, but the area is starting to slowly look better than it did like 15, 20 years ago.
Well, Greg, thank you so much with those observations, and I want to pose them to Jamie. Do you see people in Groveton commuting farther for jobs now?
Well, there aren't that many jobs even,
in
a
surrounding
half hour
area
away from here. We're very sparsely populated rural community, a million acres in our county and about 30,000 people. But I was heartened by what Greg said about the aftermath of the town after the mill closed. It sounds as if there are some sparks of economic revitalization and perhaps greater diversification, less reliance on one big employer. And frankly, that's my hope for Groveton, for Millinocket, Maine, Bucksport, Maine, for Brokaw and Rhinelander out in Wisconsin, Brainerd, Minnesota, and all these other towns that have been, I think, in an unhealthy way, over-reliant on one big industry and or one big economic engine, whatever it is. And if towns and communities can diversify into a lot of smaller businesses and services that provide high-quality, value-added services and products, I think they're going to be much more resilient, much less vulnerable to these global economic forces that doomed our paper mill and have doomed steel mills and automobile plants throughout the country over the last 30 or 40 years. And one of my messages to our community is we cannot control these global forces, but maybe we can somewhat control our vulnerability to them, somewhat mitigate the impact they have on them. But that's going to require building up local businesses, supporting our neighbors, shopping downtown instead of at the big box stores an hour away, and really rethinking our role as a consumer. Do we need all this stuff that's ending up in the landfill? Can we not derive more satisfaction from a walk in the woods, a healthy walk in healthy woods, than by just simply consuming more and more goods? And so I'm urging folks to consider what I call frugal prosperity. Meets our basic needs, allows us a little bit extra so we can pursue happiness in our own individual way, but that we really don't ask for a big material lifestyle, because we're blessed up here, as I think probably many of the folks in Wisconsin.
Let's try, and Jamie, thank you so much, and Greg, thank you. But let's try to squeeze in another call here. Let's go to Melissa in Racine. Hi, Melissa.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I appreciate the show and you writing the book. There's so much here to comment on, but I see a lot of corollaries to where I live in Kimberley. Essentially, what happened was a large hedge fund, Sybaris, came in and shut down the mill, and also, similar to the New Hampshire town you were talking about, said that if they sold the mill, nothing else, no other paper could be produced there. So there were interested buyers, but they ended up just demolishing the mill. And I don't think that anything really has sprung up in its place. And I think it's unfortunate because you can build the downtowns as much as you want, but that doesn't provide the family-supporting jobs that something like a mill would. So thank you very much.
Melissa, thanks for the call. Jamie, very sharp parallels there in what Melissa was saying to what happened in Groveton.
And I believe that this would be true throughout the country. I've always said that the stories that I've collected for the Groveton Mill are idiosyncratic to Groveton, but that the bigger picture or the bigger story that Groveton tells is much more universal, and the callers are confirming that belief.
Joyce in Ashland, go ahead. Joyce, are you there?
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
We had a James River in Ashland, Wisconsin, and they closed down, and there were a lot of unemployment, of course, and divorces, and the stores, like he said, the city of Ashland is now like a ghost town. There's no buildings, shopping there, or anything. We have a Walmart. That's all we have. And they demolished it. They couldn't sell it. They demolished it, and people just moved out. There's nothing here.
Hmm. And so do you see any signs that this may change?
No. No signs, nothing. It's nothing. There's nothing here.
You also mentioned that there have been a number of divorces, or this has really ruined some relationships.
Right, divorces, a lot of divorces, and because people couldn't make a living. Like they said before, with the old people that worked there that were over 50, they couldn't get jobs anywhere, and the young people moved away.
Well, Jamie, you spoke with a number of mill workers. What has it done to their relationships in their life?
I didn't get any stories about divorces, but I did hear a lot of stories of people being forced to uproot and just the overall heartbreak and sense of loss. One of the younger people I spoke with said that he felt that the fabric of the community was unraveling every day, and that one of the strengths of the community when he was growing up was just how strong and supportive everyone was, and he saw that weakening. And it's really hard, you know, if you're living day to day, and most of the mill workers were, they didn't like going on strike because they were living day to day, and suddenly they weren't getting that paycheck for a week or two, and that put a real stress in their ability just to put food on the table. And so you can imagine when suddenly there's no job, and this is a long-term prognosis. So I can understand what Joyce was talking about, and it frankly it's heartbreaking to me. And I see that we keep replaying this in what I call rural resource communities throughout the country. We have economic development strategies statewide, which are basically how much can we cut taxes to lure Amazon or Walmart or somebody or a car factory in, but no economic support for the ingenious local folks who have a good idea, already have a small business going, but maybe need a little boost to broaden their product line or upgrade a machine to remain competitive.
Stepping away from the economics for a moment, you interviewed some really colorful characters. Can you talk about one or two people who really stood out to you?
Well, let me start with Puss Gagner. He was about 85 when I interviewed him, and I think he was the third or fourth person I spoke with. And he was a character. First thing he told me was, I got hired at the mill when I was 15. I said, how'd you do that? He said, I lied about my age. Then he started telling me about all the shenanigans in the mill. He was the first one who told me about the heavy drinking going on in the mill. And I said, I would think there'd be more accidents in the mill if you're drinking. And he said, no, nobody ever got hurt drunk. It was when you were sober that the accidents happened. And I'm like, wow, I'm on to a pretty wild interview. He then got fired for falling asleep in the boiler control room. Well, if you're asleep at the boiler controls and something goes wrong, you could blow up the mill. He got rehired and later was in an accident where he got run over by a railroad car out in the yard, crushed his chest, and he still lived another 40 years. not only was he a wild and crazy character, but he opened me up to the kind of the social problems in the mill. And after that, I would ask people about drinking and other social problems.
And there were a number of pranks going on at the mill. Is that right?
Absolutely. I mean, these folks were real characters. But also, you have to understand, this was an incredibly stressful work environment, hotter than the blazes, because those paper machines put off a lot of heat. Smelly, noisy. Most of the people who worked around the machines have suffered permanent and serious hearing loss. They were under pressure to keep that machine running. And when the machine wasn't running, you didn't eat lunch. You were just pulling paper, bad paper off, and trying to figure out what was wrong and get it right. And so the only thing that helped them keep their sanity in really crazy times was pulling pranks. And one of the guys said, you have to understand, the work was so horrible, we had to do this or we'd go crazy.
So did you find when you talked with them that they had kept these close connections as colleagues? Did they keep these relationships going after the mill closed, after their jobs were over?
Yes, because we have mill reunions up here that started up 2 or 3 years ago, and there's always a really nice showing of former mill workers of all ages. But on the other hand, I did get a couple of funny comments from folks. One is the sense that the women who worked in the mill spent much more time together outside of the mill than the men did. I asked one of the first people I interviewed about that, and he said, "We men didn't see each other after the mill. We saw enough of each other at the mill." It was just a kind of a funny, curt comment. But I think that this being a very small community, everybody's kids being in the same school, et cetera, I think there was an awful lot of camaraderie outside of the mill.
And are those mill reunions still going on?
Oh, yeah, we had one in April, and actually I did a presentation at a Legion Hall breakfast a few weeks ago, and I just put together a loop of about 100 photographs, and we had them showing on the wall while folks were eating breakfast, and then they came over, and we just had really pleasant chit-chats, and everybody was, I missed the mill. It was, you know, it was great working there, which surprised me. I thought I was going to get a lot more of the "I hated it" kind of thing, but so many of the people who worked there really did appreciate the job, despite the really, you know, adverse working conditions.
Well, Jamie, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Jamie Sion is a writer and environmental activist. His new book is You Had a Job for Life, Story of a Company Town. We reached him in Stratford, New Hampshire. This hour of the morning show was produced by Chris Molina and Keely Baltina. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer Kent. This is the Ideas Network.